Welcome to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Good afternoon. I'm Larry Jacobs, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to today's program, The Continuing Fight for Fair Housing. This is the second in our Mondale Dialogue series that's focused on the living legacy of Walter Mondale, who was Vice President of the United States, and before that, U.S. Senator, and before that, many other things. For those who are familiar with American history, you become accustomed to the phrase before and after Walter Mondale. Before Walter Mondale, the vice president's sole job was standby in case the president died or was killed. After Mondale, the vice president became a singular advisor and unique actor working with the president. And every president and vice president since Mondale followed the Mondale model. Before Mondale, judicial supervision of foreign intelligence did not happen. We had all sorts of unwarranted eavesdropping and other sorts of clandestine activities on the U.S. soil. That changed with Walter Mondale. After Walter Mondale, we had a series of legal structures, including those that are supervised by federal judges. That leads to today's topic, fair housing. Before Mondale, the federal government accepted or supported explicit racial discrimination when it came to housing. Even by the late 1960s, it looked as if that might continue, despite the surge of critical and landmark civil rights legislation, including the Basic Charter passed in 1964 of civil rights, and then the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Housing was on pretty much nobody's list to do it. Their political obstacles were enormous and intimidating to most. But when a young U.S. Senator named Walter Mondale volunteered to take it on, his staff had a glum response. Thanks, boss. Mondale and a broad coalition inside Congress and outside would rally, and they would overcome the odds and pass the Fair Housing Act of 1968. The Fair Housing Act, for the first time, put the federal government on the side of prohibiting discrimination in the sale, rental, and financing of housing. Fair housing, though, is both a landmark and the start of a running debate that you will hear today. What are its fundamental purposes, aims, goals, accomplishments, and limitations? And I want to invite you, and particularly and including those of you joining us online, to participate in today's event. For those of you online, there is a Q&A button just at the bottom of your screen, and that's your opportunity to submit questions. We use those questions. Please submit them, click on them, and we're going to get them to our moderators. If you here in the live audience would like to participate, there will be folks walking around with cards. Please write your questions down there. And we'll get to those as well at a given time. We also have live captioning for those of you online, and you can again see that at the bottom of the screen. Okay, now it's my pleasure to introduce you to our first panel that will be discussing the history of Fair Housing Act. And as I do this, I want to give a particular welcome to the moderator, Professor Ed Goetz, who was a vital advisor, doer, and partner in putting together today's conference. Thank you very much, Ed Goetz. And now I'd like to introduce with Ed Goetz, Greg Squires from George Washington University. Please give them a warm welcome.
Thank you very much, Larry. Appreciate the thanks, and also appreciate the context for our talk today. Before we talk about the Fair Housing Act, I'd like to begin by asking you how to characterize the nation's attitude and approach to the idea of fair housing.
Yeah, first, I do want to thank Ed and Larry and everybody for inviting me here. This is I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I think that's a vital question, because I think in some respects, one of the constants has been that the nation's attitude hasn't changed all that much. And I would characterize it as one of ambiguity, if not resistance, but always quite race conscious. And let me just read three quotes that I think illustrate this. And the first is from one of my favorite people, Phil Oakes. How many people in this room know the name Phil Oakes? I see two or three hands. Phil Oakes was a great folk singer, protest songwriter, worked for Robert Kennedy and on a number of progressive causes. Unfortunately, he died very young in 1976. But in 1966, he should have won the Nobel Prize that Bob Dylan won. But that's an aside. In 1966, he recorded a song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal. And one of the lines in that song was, I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. And I think that somewhat captures the ambiguity. Now, a few years earlier in 1963, let me read you a comment from George Wallace, which wasn't so ambiguous. And he says, today I have stood where once Jefferson Davis stood and took an oath to my people. It is very appropriate then from this cradle of the Confederacy, this very heart of the great Anglo-Saxon Southland, that today we sound the drum of freedom as have our generations of forebears before us done time and time again through history. Let us rise to the call of freedom-loving blood that is in us all and send our answers to the tyranny that clanks its chains upon the South. In the name of the greatest people that ever trod the earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny. And I say, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Now, this was 50, 60 years ago. Times have changed, and we know that things are much better. But maybe they aren't, because about 2 years ago, President Donald Trump offered the following comment when he rescinded an Obama-era fair housing rule. This is a rule that implemented the Fair Housing Act's longstanding requirement that recipients of federal housing and community development funds take affirmative action, that they are required to affirmatively further fair housing. I'll have more about to say the AFFH in a few minutes. But when Trump came into office, he basically rescinded the rule that Obama had passed. And in doing so, he says, quote, you know, the suburbs, people fight all of their lives to get into the suburbs and have a beautiful home. There will be no more affordable housing forced into the suburbs. It's been going on for years. I've seen conflict for years. It's been hell in suburbia. We rescinded the rule 3 days ago. And so enjoy your life, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy your life. Now, it seems to me George Wallace was only a little more articulate, but it's the same basic message. And this occurred to me 4 or 5 days ago, and I thought this was a brilliant original insight that I had. And then 2 days ago, I read George Will's column in the Washington Post, where he said you could draw a direct line from George Wallace to Donald Trump. And normally, I don't like to quote George Will and support what he has to say, unless he's writing about the Chicago Cubs. But I think that that's an important, there is a direct line between those two people. And I think that continues to characterize what has been this nation's attitude towards the idea of fair housing.
Yeah. So given this ambiguity at best, but active resistance, perhaps most frequently, how did the Fair Housing Act come to pass in 1968?
Well, it was a struggle. Now, the great historian Michael Katz has written and spoken many times about how we have a tendency to look back at historical events and assume that it was just sort of inevitable what happened. And now, 60 years after the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, I think we have a tendency to think, well, that was just the natural outgrowth. We went from slavery to Jim Crow to the civil rights rules, you know, the march of history. But in fact, there was nothing inevitable about the civil rights legislation of the 60s, and particularly the Fair Housing Act.
Just to give you a few examples of what was happening at the time. First, we have people like George Wallace, and there were many who were saying the same things that he was saying. When Lyndon Johnson attempted to create a Federal Fair Housing Act, he initially did it, I think, in 1966. And he lost in 66, he lost in 67, and it didn't look like he was going to have much luck in 1968. But 1968 was kind of a perfect storm. A number of things came together. First, we had a continuation of the violence in hundreds of cities all over the country. Second, we had the Kerner Commission report that was issued earlier that year that explicitly put the blame on white racism as the cause of the violence in cities. And then third, we had Martin Luther King assassinated. And after years of trying to get a bill through Congress, 7 days after the assassination of MLK, the Fair Housing Act was passed, and Johnson signed it into law. Now, Johnson was known to be a great horse trader. He made all kinds of deals, and I haven't even touched on all he was doing. But I do have one story that involves Mayor Daley of Chicago, the boss, that I think also captures the struggle for this law. In 1968, Everett Dirksen, who was a Republican senator from Illinois, faced a very difficult reelection campaign. And Daley, for reasons only he will understand, was a supporter of the Fair Housing Act. He wanted to support LBJ. And as the boss, he was the one who was going to determine who Everett's opponent would be in the next election. And he had three very powerful, attractive Democrats to choose from. One was Sergeant Shriver, the Kennedy family. One was Adlai Stevenson II, the son of a presidential candidate on two occasions. And a third was Paul Simon, a popular Illinois state legislator who did go on to become a senator. So Daley went up to Everett Dirksen and made a deal. He said, if you will, and Dirksen, I should say, was on the fence. He would never commit to being a supporter of the Fair Housing Act. So Daley offered him a deal where if he would agree to support the Fair Housing Act, Daley was going to name William A. Clark as the candidate to run against him in the election. Nobody had heard of William Clark, and Dirksen knew it would be easier for him to win. So with that, that's just one example of the many stories that reflected the struggle to get the Fair Housing Act passed. And even when it was passed, it was a very weak version of what the proponents were hoping to get. Under the Fair Housing Act in 1968, HUD was the primary federal agency for enforcement, but all HUD could do if a complaint was filed was negotiate to try to conciliate a complaint with the parties or refer the case to the Justice Department. At the time, it had very limited enforcement. The enforcement provisions of the Fair Housing Act were strengthened 20 years later in the Fair Housing Amendment Act in 1988, but the bill was a pretty weak version when it was passed in 68.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the difficulty of getting that law passed, that even under the circumstances that existed in 68, it took important compromises to get the law
passed. Right, right.
Yeah. So then what has happened since? Can we talk about implementation of the law or its impact?
We can. And I've given a lot of thought to this over the years. And it occurred to me this is a classic case of where the glass is half full and it's half empty. And I say it's half full. I'll offer you a few numbers. Okay. The Black-White Index of Dissimilarity, which is a measure of segregation, an index of dissimilarity of 100 would be a city or a community where that was completely segregated. All whites lived over here, all blacks lived over there. An index of dissimilarity of 0 would be an indication that all neighborhoods had basically the same racial composition as the entire community. The Black-White Index of Dissimilarity dropped from 80 in 1970 to 53 in 2020. More positive signs. In 2012, the Urban Institute with HUD conducted a nationwide study of housing discrimination, something that the Urban Institute did with HUD four times over roughly between 1980 and 2012. And in 2012, they found that white and non-white home seekers were equally likely to get an appointment when they contacted a real estate agent. This is very different than in 1979 or 1980, the first time the study was done, when something like 20% of Black home seekers were unable to get an appointment. The share of whites favoring laws prohibiting racial discrimination in housing increased from 37% in 1972 to 69% in 2008. And my final bullet here is $6 trillion have been invested in traditionally underserved neighborhoods in recent years, in part due to the Community Reinvestment Act, which is a federal law that prohibits redlining, as well as the Fair Housing Act and other fair lending rules. So we see some important positive measures. But I say the glass is half empty because in 2010, the typical Black family lived in a neighborhood that was 35% white compared to 40% in 1940. So the typical Black had more white neighbors in 1940 than they had in 2010. In 2012, although whites and Blacks were equally likely to be able to get an appointment with a real estate agent, whites were told about and shown more homes than were equally qualified Black home seekers. Hypersegregation persists today, particularly in those cities that have particularly large concentrations or high numbers of a Black population. In 2014, 28% of whites reported that they believed they should have the right to keep Blacks out of their neighborhood, and they would favor a law that would allow such rights. Today, we've seen evidence of gentrification resulting in displacement, both geographic displacement and cultural and political displacement in many cities. A final note, which may be positive or negative, about a month ago or 2 months ago, the National Fair Housing Alliance released a report where it reported that the number of fair housing complaints filed with HUD, with the Department of Justice, with state agencies, and with private nonprofit fair housing groups, the number filed in 2022 was the largest number that had ever been filed since they began collecting this data back in the mid-90s. There were something like 33,000 housing discrimination complaints that were filed. Now, actually, I don't know if this is good or bad. I mean, if the incidence of housing discrimination continues to rise, and if there were 33,000, that's probably not a very positive indicator. But maybe that's an indication that we have developed better agencies that are more responsive in dealing with these kinds of complaints. And maybe people who are victims of housing discrimination have a little more confidence today in the enforcement machinery we have than they did 10 or 15 years ago. But it's another indication. And I think that perhaps the bellwether that I would point to is the National Association of Realtors, which has been at the heart of much of these debates for decades. In 1950, the National Association of Realtors, in their code of ethics, said, quote, "A realtor should never be instrumental in introducing into a neighborhood a character of property or occupancy, members of any race or nationality, or any individual whose presence will clearly be detrimental to property values in the neighborhood." There was no question which people would be detrimental to property values in a neighborhood. That was in 1950. But in some respects, the National Association of Realtors has come a long way. Today, if you read the Code of Ethics, I think it's a 3 or 4 page statement of all kinds of positive observation. I'll just read a couple. Realtors shall not deny equal professional services to any person for reasons of race, color, religion, sex, handicap, familial status, national origin, sexual orientation, or gender identity. And it goes on, realtors shall not print, display, or circulate any statement or advertisement with respect to selling or renting of a property that indicates any preference, limitations, or discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, handicap, familial status, national origin, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Now, this is the code of ethics that is put together by an organization that is headquartered in Washington, D.C., just a couple blocks from the Capitol building. It's clear from the complaint numbers I just gave that the message has not trickled down to all members of the National Association of Realtors. So my answer to your question is, like I say, the bottle's half full or it's half empty.
There's also, though, been a wide variety, a wide variation in the earnestness and the eagerness with which administrations have implemented the Fair Housing Act, right? And that tends to move back and forth. You mentioned the Obama era AFFH, and then Trump removes it. It's going to be put back in by the next. This is sort of typical of the implementation of the law over time, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it's and there's been a lot of back and forth. And one of the issues on which there's been a lot of back and forth has been the question of whether should the focus be on helping people of color access neighborhoods that they have traditionally not had access to, or should the focus be on investing in distressed communities so that people can stay where they are and live better. Your question, the two issues that I want to get to where there has been some back and forth are basically the disparate impact, AFFH things, and I'll get to those in a minute. But I'd like to address this ongoing debate because I think this provides a context or framework for the nuts and bolts of the back and forth between Obama and Trump and Biden. I think that Walter Mondale, one of the co-sponsors of the Fair Housing Act, said that above all, Congress intended, as the Supreme Court recently held, that the Fair Housing Act serve as a new powerful tool to end racial residential segregation, to replace ghettos with vibrant and racially integrated neighborhoods. So integration was clearly a goal for many of the proponents. But there's been a lot of debate over this, and there's been a lot of debate over some of the mechanisms we've employed to try to achieve this integration. There have been a number of so-called mobility experiments, efforts to help people from low-income, predominantly non-white neighborhoods move to other neighborhoods. Maybe the best-known example is the Moving to Opportunity program, which was a 10-year research effort in the 1990s, launched in 5 cities. And the initial findings from this effort showed that the families that moved from high poverty to low poverty neighborhoods, when it came to income and wealth and those kinds of employment or economic measures, there wasn't a whole lot there. There were some health benefits, but the employment benefits were disappointing. More recently, Raj Chetty and his colleagues have looked at the children of these families and found that particularly among young children, those under 13 years of age, those who did move to low poverty areas had adult incomes that were 30% higher than those who did not make such a move. And Chetty has found a number of other measures that showed that this move did have a positive effect. And it wasn't just self-selection. It wasn't just because the parents who made the move, they were more driven to help their kids. Because what Chetty found was that the younger the child, the more years they spent in the low poverty neighborhoods, the better they did as adults, even within the same family. So if there was like a 12-year-old and a 3-year-old in the same family when they made the move, the 3-year-old did much better as an adult than did the 12-year-old. Now, for kids over 13 years of age, or families that had kids over 13 years of age, the results were actually negative rather than positive. So there's that ongoing discussion. But there's long been, I think, an understanding that it's not surprising that if you move from a high poverty, predominantly Black neighborhood to a middle income or upper income, predominantly white neighborhood, that things will be better. Research has shown that the middle class, more professional neighborhoods, they have safer streets. There's more recreational amenities. The schools are better. There are fewer environmental hazards. In many cities, you find that life expectancy differs by as much as 10 years between two neighborhoods that are two or three miles apart from each other because of exposure to environmental hazards. So the Chetty findings aren't all that surprising, but I think it's important to have that concrete evidence to support what I think a lot of people knew intuitively. But I think it's fair to say these kinds of moves are not the priority today that they were perhaps back in the 60s at the height of the civil rights movement, that particularly for people of color professionals, we often read that integration is not their goal. They want the amenities that we become accustomed to in predominantly white middle-class neighborhoods, but they don't necessarily place the same emphasis on integration. In Joe Fagan and Melvin Sykes' book, Living with Racism, they interview a lot of middle-class African-Americans. And one of the accountants that they interviewed was a guy who said, I put up with racism all day at work. I don't need to put up with it when I come home. Mindy Fuller-Love wrote a great book called Root Shock, where she focused on urban renewal and the program called Hope Six. These are programs that were not voluntary, where people were forced to move from one neighborhood to the next, and found that there were serious mental and physical health problems associated with these moves. She referred to this as disrupting their emotional ecosystem. She opens the book with an interesting discussion of what it meant to residents of Brooklyn when the Brooklyn Dodgers moved out. I recommend that you read at least the first page of her book. And there's also the argument that the desegregation often disrupts community ties, that people may be poor, but they rely on each other. They have a sense of community. They can help each other. And these mobility programs break those ties. This is something you and I have talked about and disagreed about for about 15 years. But it's part of the reality. And our good friend Chester Hartman, a great progressive planner, often said that people have the right to stay put. And what he meant by that is people shouldn't have to move to get good schools. But there is an alternative vision that I think is important to consider, that for many families, it was only when they made a move to a low poverty neighborhood that they discovered any sense of community. There was a program in Chicago called the Getro program. This is the result of a lawsuit the plaintiffs filed against the Chicago Housing Authority and HUD, because the city was concentrating public housing, frankly, in Chicago's Black ghetto. And the courts ruled that there was unlawful discrimination and created a program that would allow families to move out. And between 1976 and 1998, over 7,000 families moved from Chicago's high poverty neighborhoods, predominantly Black neighborhoods, to lower poverty, predominantly white neighborhoods in Chicago and in the suburbs. Jim Rosenbaum, a sociologist at Northwestern, has followed these families and found a number of positive effects, including the creation of community. Many of these families who in their former neighborhoods wouldn't let their kids go outside and play because they were dangerous. They wouldn't talk to their neighbors because they didn't know if their neighbors were involved in drugs, gangs, or whatever. They didn't want to have anything to do with anything bordering on community. But many of these families, when they moved, found that they did have a sense of community. They had neighbors who would come and watch their kids when they got sick so they could go to work. They had neighbors they could borrow a car from so they could get to work when their car broke down. And one instance, Rosenbaum interviewed a woman who said that it was only when she moved to the Chicago suburb that she realized they were ugly white people, because the only white people she had ever seen in her life were people she had seen on television and in movies. And this is a real enlightened for her. So this is sort of a background to get to your question about, you know, the shift from administration to administration. Mm-hmm. Having said all this, I think it's fair to say that most people who have followed this stuff will argue for both the right to move as well as for reinvestment. In fact, I haven't run across anybody who said the only thing we should focus on is integration and let the inner city be damned. Nobody has said we need to put all of our resources in the inner city and we shouldn't worry about whether or not people of color can move to the suburbs. But I think it is the case that different parties to this debate have placed different priorities on these. Now, to your question on the shifts from administration to administration, okay, Let me spend a couple minutes here. And I do want to talk particularly about what's called disparate impact and affirmatively furthering fair housing. Now, disparate impact are there any lawyers in the room? That's too bad. Well, the two of you can correct me here. It's the idea that under certain circumstances, there may be a violation of a civil rights law, even though there's no proof of any intent to discriminate. This was clearly established by the Supreme Court when it came to employment in the case of Griggs versus Duke Power back, I think, in 1971, something like that. But it hadn't been so clearly established in housing. And in 2008, the Inclusive Communities Project in Texas filed a lawsuit against the state of Texas. And it had to do with tax credits that the federal government provided to provide incentives for affordable housing. Federal government provided the incentives, but it was the state that determined where these tax credits would go. And the state of Texas had this policy of focusing the tax credits to high poverty neighborhoods. And Inclusive Communities said that what happens is in predominantly Black inner city areas, there were too few credits, too many credits in predominantly Black inner city areas, and too few in predominantly white suburban neighborhoods. In other words, because the policy was based on income of neighborhoods, it had a disparate impact on people of color. The state of Texas was not being accused necessarily of intentionally discriminating because of race, but because this particular policy or practice had a disparate impact on people of color, they argued that this was a violation of the law. And in 2015, the Supreme Court said, you're right. And it established a disparate impact standard under the Fair Housing Act. Now, in a disparate impact case, there's sort of three stages. You as the plaintiff first have to establish that there is a particular policy or practice that has an adverse impact on a protected class member. But the respondent or the housing provider that you're charging can come back and say, but that policy or practice is an essential business practice. Then the plaintiff has the right to come back and say, but there is a less discriminatory alternative that will meet your business practice. And the employer then would be required to follow that. So it's a somewhat complex legal argument, and I'm oversimplifying it to some extent, but that's sort of the basic plan. Obama then issued a regulation that clarified with much specificity as to what disparate impact required. It was a very strong rule, but Trump rescinded it. And Trump, well, maybe it's unfair to say he rescinded. He replaced it with a different rule. And under the Trump rule, he said that first a plaintiff would have to prove that a policy or practice was arbitrary and served no legitimate purpose. So the burden is on the plaintiff to prove a negative. And even if the plaintiff was able to prove the negative, the respondent could be off the hook if the defendant could demonstrate that the policy or practice in question was a standard industry practice. So in other words, as long as what you wanted to do was a form of discrimination that everybody else in your industry was practicing, if everybody else is discriminating, that was the defense. You could do it, and that's basically the Trump era disparate impact rule. That's a bit of oversimplification, perhaps, but not too much of an oversimplification. Biden has since rescinded the Trump rule and reinstated the Obama rule. Let me talk about affirmatively furthering fair housing for a moment. There has long been, since the Fair Housing Act was enacted in 1968, an obligation on jurisdictions that receive housing or community development money to affirmatively further fair housing. But this is a rule that had basically been ignored until maybe the mid-1990s, when a handful of lawsuits were filed. And as a result of these lawsuits, the Obama administration implemented a regulation clarifying what this meant. And basically, it meant that jurisdictions had to do an investigation to identify those policies or practices that led to the segregation. And they had to work with community groups in doing that investigation. Once those factors were identified, they then had to develop a plan to overcome or remedy those practices that led to that. And then they had to assess the progress they were making later. This was the basic structure of the rule that Obama administered. Trump took care of this one as well, and enacted a rule that did not, first of all, it required no community participation. It provided incentives for developers to build affordable housing, but it said nothing about discrimination. And it basically was a complete dilution of AFFH. The Biden administration has promulgated a rule. They're about to issue the final rule, we think, in the very near future. I'm not saying tomorrow, but within the next few weeks or a couple months, it's quite possible that there'll be a new rule. Now,
Greg, we've got just 5 minutes left.
We've got 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
final thoughts.
Well, all right. Having said that, well, yeah, lots of final thoughts. A couple of things I don't want to get.
Sure.
So let me say a few things about what I think are the some of the major barriers today and what some of the reasons for optimism are. I think that today, again, there is this debate as to what extent should federal agencies be pursuing integration as a policy. And I'm looking for notes here that the Supreme Court issued a decision a few months ago banning affirmative action on colleges and universities. And in his concurring opinion, Clarence Thomas said that there's no justice, no justification for any racial determination or measurement or a policy of any kind anywhere. And this raises a question of whether things like community benefits agreements would be prohibited. Would special purpose credit programs be prohibited? Would any effort to create an integrated community be prohibited because it's race conscious? The Wall Street Journal has chimed in that the reach of the proposed law was to replace. The Wall Street Journal proposed that corporate diversity and equity programs that divide and classify by race should also be in notice that they will face legal challenges. So much of what has been done in the name of race equity now is vulnerable, which contradicts the initial intent of the Fair Housing Act. This is a Mondale celebration, and I want to read a couple observations from Walter Mondale that were more recent in reference to the 68 Act. Now, he did say the reach of the proposed law was to replace the ghettos with truly integrated and balanced living patterns. But he went on in 2018 to say, and I've quoted some length, as the events of 68 have receded from memory, the full scope of the FHA has been lost on some modern interlocutors. A particularly narrow conception of race blindness has sometimes taken hold. The idea that any policy that perceives race, no matter its substance, is per se racially discriminatory. Some of those operating with this simplified view have attempted to invert the Fair Housing Act, arguing that proactive attempts to build integration, because they at times must necessarily acknowledge race themselves, can constitute a form of racial discrimination and are thus forbidden by the act. The error in this line of reasoning would have seemed clear in 68. Congress was confronted with daily reminders of the impact of race on Americans. It would have found careful agnosticism towards these realities absurd. Integration builds a society in which race is less relevant. Blinding ourselves to race's role in our cities does not. Yet that is precisely how some would have us implement the FHA today. So let me say a minute or two about positive things. Do I have a minute?
You've got a minute.
Okay. I mean, the reason why I think there's some reason to be optimistic, I think today there's an infrastructure of fair housing and fair lending advocacy that didn't exist in 1968. We have organizations like the National Fair Housing Alliance, the National Community Investment Coalition, Center for Responsible Lending. There is advocacy for these things. There are some sympathetic journalists and reporters, foundations, some elected officials that are supportive. We don't find people explicitly articulating what George Wallace said as much. I still choose to believe Donald Trump is not the rule. So I think there's a base of advocacy. I think the FHA was an absolutely critical breakthrough, but as many have said about democracy itself, it is a great tool as long as we can keep it. This is contested terrain. It remains to be seen what's going to happen, but I choose to believe that there's a light at the end of the tunnel and that it is not a train coming the other way.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate that. Do we have an opportunity for a question or two, or should we transition to the next
panel? We should transition.
We should transition to the next panel. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. So my name is Ingrid Ellen, and I'm on the faculty at the Wagner School of Public Service at NYU, and I'm really delighted to be here. I want to take 1 minute to just sort of add a personal note, which is that it turns out that that my father grew up in the very same remote rural farm valley in the fjords of Norway that Walter Mondale's ancestors did. And so my father always insisted that we were cousins, which actually is probably true, given that there wasn't a lot of movement in and out of this very remote part of the fjords. And the Moondals, which was Walter Mondale's family name in Norway, and the Boyums, there was a lot of intermarriage. So in any case, my family, my father and his family took just enormous pride in their connection to Walter Mondale. And let me just say, we were just a huge fan in my family of Walter Mondale. And I was just in Norway this summer, and the village where my father came from, they still talk with just beam with pride about Walter Mondale. So it's a really special honor for me to be here. It's also a special honor for me to be engage in a conversation with these fantastic panelists. I'm not going to go through their impressive bios because you have those in your program, but let me just say briefly, we've got Shannon Smith-Jones from the United Way and Myron Orfield from down the road from the University of Minnesota. I guess it's the Mondale Law School, is that right? Okay.
Mondale, huh?
And Maureen Michalski from Ryan Companies. So thanks to all of you for participating. Greg just, very eloquently laid out, the Fair Housing Act really has sort of two different components, right? The first, and two different aims. The first was to outlaw individual acts of discrimination, and the second was to foster integration, or again, in the words of Walter Mondale, as he said, the act was intended to produce truly, truly integrated and balanced living patterns. And so I'm going to try to structure the conversation to sort of break it up into those two parts, those two elements of the Fair Housing Act. And our aim is to talk about kind of contemporary challenges, right? What more work do we have to do? And I appreciate sort of Greg, again, this transitions nicely from the sort of end of Greg and Ed's conversation. And I will say, Greg said, it's sort of the question is the glass half full, glass half empty? I mean, I think there's lots of evidence that the Fair Housing Act succeeded enormously in reducing the incidence of discrimination, but there's also ample evidence that housing market discrimination still persists. And so my first question is sort of for all three of you, and maybe Myron, I'll start with you, is sort of what other strategies should we take to reduce the incidence of discrimination by realtors, by landlords, by lenders?
Well, I think these are really important questions. We have some of the worst mortgage lending discrimination between Blacks and whites in the United States. The evidence shows that our steering, when we do testing for study, is a very very stark pattern of Black and Latino families being steered to some suburbs and whites away from those. I mean, there's two major lawsuits going on in the region right now, one under federal law, which is the MICA case, and the other under state law, which is the stair step case. Plaintiffs are here today. Hopefully they can talk a little bit about it. But one of the major issues is that the State Housing Finance Agency, the Met Council, has abandoned a lot of good strategies that it used to use in the 1960s and 70s. And it's resulted in an explosion of racial segregation. We went from almost no segregated schools in the 1990s to 190 elementary schools that are more than 90% non-white and poor. It's the fastest growth of segregated schools anywhere in the country. And instead of building housing in a way that would alleviate that, we've decided to move away from building housing that would help integrate the schools to building it almost entirely within the footprint of segregated schools. And it's resulted in great inequality. The plaintiffs are arguing that at the heart of this case, the major force of the fair housing law and the Minnesota.
Can I hold off on 1 second? Because I want you to talk about that in the second half of this discussion at this point. So I don't know whether, you know, do we need more testing, for instance, fair housing testing?
We do. And I think one of the reasons that we don't have testing is because the state agencies have believed that it's not required. If you believe integration is the fundamental goal of the Fair Housing Act, you have to do testing. It's an obligation. If you want to have an integrated housing market, you have to do it. But if you've decided that integration isn't the goal, it's just another thing.
But even if you have a, you know, sort of limit, if you're just paying attention to the half of the Fair Housing Act, right, mm-hmm. that's about outlawing individual acts of discrimination, it mm-hmm. seems to me there's a good argument that we need more funding and support for testing. And it also seems to me that technology allows us to do this in a pretty cheap way today.
Yeah. I mean, the plaintiffs have argued for this, that we should do testing, that this is an obligation, but people don't believe that it's required by law and they don't do it. And it's an easy thing to do. It shows discrimination. It's starkly bad. The Urban Institute found that Black families 90% of the time are steered in terms of their choices and white families are overwhelmingly steered away. We haven't really done any testing since the 1990s. But the plaintiffs in both of these cases say that it's required. But the agencies, because integration isn't a goal, they don't feel compelled to do it and they don't do it. Yeah. So, I mean, it should be done. It is cheap. It is effective. It's very powerful evidence. It would certainly show discrimination. But if you don't believe integration is a goal of the law, you don't have to do it.
So, Shannon, can I turn to you sort of again, thinking about sort of what other strategies we could take to combat discrimination in the private market by realtors, again, landlords, lenders?
Well, I definitely agree with Myron around testing and discrimination. I think the thing that I struggle with around integration being the only goal is that we're not addressing discrimination, right? Mm-hmm. So while we can integrate and say you need to move to opportunity areas or what have you, it still does not mitigate the trauma and or experiences that people might engage in moving into those communities. I think some of the strategies, and I think Professor Squires talked about this, is investing in place. So Minneapolis right now, you can take your kids and go to school in whatever district you want, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you were investing in those schools, if you were investing in local businesses, if you were investing in those places and spaces and people, then some of the discrimination and some of the segregation that mm-hmm. you're seeing as a result of that wouldn't exist. I would go on to say in housing, Minneapolis passed a rule in 2020 around criteria for renting. Mm-hmm. And some of that was they found that folks who created misdemeanors had no impact on whether or not they would pay rent or not. And so they've shifted that where you can no longer do that. But the Federal Reserve did a test mm-hmm. recently and realized that while they removed some of those screening criteria, people are still being discriminated against based on names, right? So if they see African-American mm-hmm. names or Black names, they're being discriminated against at less than like 10% less likely to rent to, whereas before mm-hmm. it was 10%. And now after they made the law, I would say white renters are increased at 16%, mm-hmm. whereas there was a loss there. And so I think some of the practices and the testing possibly, mm-hmm. but some of these rules that are intended to have the impact that they are having still are not addressing the individual discrimination that people are experiencing. And there's no accountability mm-hmm. to those that are the perpetrators of that discrimination.
Yeah. So a lot of this is sort of there might be screening criteria that you're saying that aren't race conscious on the racially explicit on their face. Right.
Right.
But that actually have that disparate impact. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I mean, and you mentioned criminal background, yes. You mentioned credit scores, which are both, I think, really important. And I think, by the way, just to the researchers listening, I also think we need more research to study whether those actually are predictive of rent payment, right? I think we actually don't know that. What you didn't mention, and I'd like to ask actually Maureen to maybe talk to this, is source of income discrimination. So I actually have been doing a lot of work on the lease-up rates of housing choice voucher holders around the country. So just for people who don't know, the housing choice voucher is our largest federal rental assistance program. And it is disproportionately used by renters of color. It's aimed, basically, low-income renters pay about 30% of their income on rent, and the government, local housing agencies pay the balance up to a rent ceiling. And it's an incredibly successful program, important program for those who are families, who are households, who are able to use their vouchers. But our research is showing that 2 in 5 households who receive vouchers, after waiting on average for like 2.5 years to receive their vouchers, are unsuccessful in using their voucher and actually have to return it to the housing agency and go back to the bottom of the waiting list. Right? And a big part of this is because many landlords don't want to accept vouchers. And so, Maureen, with that, I know you're a developer and you're not on the sort of management side, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what more we could do to reduce that, to sort of make landlords more open to, or incentivize landlords to take more, to accept more voucher holders.
Sure. And maybe I'll talk about it from a broader perspective first. You know, the lowest quartile of income earners in the United States, you know, they've had stagnant income growth, right? And while others have seen their incomes increase with inflation. And so we have a renter cost burden issue. So it's really important, because those folks can't find housing in any market in the United States without any subsidy. So subsidy is very important. And so in order for that to occur, you know, there's programs like Section 8. Section 8, unfortunately, comes with a HAP contract.
Which is the Housing Choice Voucher.
Housing Choice Voucher program comes with the necessity for the landlord to enter into an agreement with the federal government, a HAP contract that, you know, takes precedence over the actual lease with the tenant, and creates a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of difficulty in quickly leasing of the units. It also is just takes away some of the landlord's or housing provider's rights in that document, and doesn't give assurances for potential payment or recourse and other issues. So there's some problems with that that agreement, which is disincentive for landlords or housing providers to accept that that form of payment. And so, you know, what can be done differently? So technology has evolved, right? There are opportunities where there's programs like Housing First in Minnesota. You know, in Minneapolis, there's a guaranteed basic income pilot. There's stable homes, stable schools. So these are other programs that provide direct subsidy, you know, essentially cash to families, so that they can use that cash for their housing needs. And it just kind of gets away from the issue of the mechanics of and the burdens of the Section 8 bureaucracy for the landlord, and provides more flexibility and less intrusion for the tenant as well. So things like that, I think, are interesting mm-hmm. solutions that we should be looking to help support those renters at the very lowest incomes.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Certainly, I think we do need to figure out ways to make the Housing Choice Voucher program work better, both for tenants and for landlords. You know, racial disparities exist not only in who gets access to homes, but who actually gets to keep their homes. Right? We see that Black and Hispanic homeowners are more likely to lose their homes to foreclosures, that Black and Hispanic renters are more likely to face eviction. I mean, the Eviction Lab recently found that Black Americans make up around sort of 20% of renters, but account for about half of evictions. And so, you know, Shannon, maybe I can ask you, it's sort of like, what landlords, I mean, you were a landlord, right? I mean, what landlords legitimately need to collect rent, right? But what can we do to minimize the use of evictions and the cost of evictions for and their racially disparate impacts?
Well, I think one, we know we live in a state where income is divided along racial lines, right? So you're already going to have a disproportionate of community members of color that are not reading that meeting that threshold. So one, I think it costs a lot to, as a landlord, it costs a lot to evict someone, right? Like the housing eviction notice is what, $285. You got to go to court and get a writ. You got to turn over the unit. You have to have somebody come in and interview a bunch of new tenants in order to get it. Mm-hmm. So like it costs money, right, to evict someone and turn over a unit. I absolutely agree with Maureen that there needs to be some ways of figuring out whether it's vouchers, whether it's rent. That is the main reason people get evicted in the state is their inability to pay rent, right? So like, I can't pay my rent. I get an unlawful detainer. I probably lose my furniture because if I can't pay rent, I probably can't get a moving truck, right? I then get costs charged more because now the landlord's going to charge me because now they had to clean my unit. So I'm not going to get my deposit back, right? And now I might be unhoused. Like, so like there's all of these things that just keep adding up the cost, and the burden is on the people who have the inability to do it most. Even in an unlawful detainer case where you're getting filed and for an eviction, generally the burden is on the resident, mm-hmm. right? So even if they are found to be not wrong, they still have that unlawful detainer. Although they did just change that, I think in 2024, if they find at the beginning of the year, if they find that the tenant is not wrong, that they can do an expungement in that moment. Okay. But the unlawful detainers then are an additional burden on that resident of finding their next place to live, right? Okay. And so there are some things that are built in. I would even challenge to think that the way the whole process is set up in mm-hmm. a way that benefits the developers more than it benefits the residents. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we figured out a way of taking that tax credit and those things on the builder side and brought it down to the other side, that those actually could probably be rental subsidies,
yeah,
right? That really could help flip the way we're thinking about it.
Yeah, interesting, creative ideas. And Maureen, do you want to talk briefly about just sort of like whether there are, I mean, are there unintended consequences to?
Yeah, I think that maybe just a couple comments. And again, I'm not on the operator side, I'm on the developer side. But in talking with our operator partners who are, you know, we're a national developer. We have most of our investors are institutional investors. And so we have sophisticated property management companies that, you know, respond to all the laws and regulations and things like that. So that's really important for us. And what I hear from all of them is, you know, operators don't want to file an eviction. As Shannon was saying, it's a total pain. It costs a lot of money. No one really wants to do it. And so usually in talking with operators, they say, well, we usually try to work with the tenants within some period of time and in more informal period at the beginning of the month. You know, they say, well, we're going to be getting I'm going to be getting paid on this date. You know, can you wait a couple of days? And that's usually how it works. And what I think is going to be interesting is to see coming in January, now we have the 14-day notice for filing an eviction and how that changes that process, because mm-hmm. because the operators are now incentivized to file that eviction earlier because they have this notice period before their mortgage is due the next month. And so I think that's maybe a potential unintended consequences that informal working with people, trying to give them a little more leeway is going to be not as common or maybe more difficult given the larger time period for notice. So something to just to be thinking about. And then, you know, the emergency assistance, obviously Hennepin County is the largest place of eviction filings in the state. And so emergency assistance to help residents in need is really important, and particularly at the county level. And I know that the Family Housing Fund is contributing technical assistance to a statewide study group analyzing this issue. So that might be something for folks to keep an eye out for as well.
That's great. Well, we'll definitely keep an eye out. I mean, it does seem like certainly thinking about sort of administrative mechanisms for collecting rent for landlords that, don't involve the courts, right? And then thinking also about ways that that the evictions and the eviction filings themselves can be less costly for tenants, right? To undermine their future housing search. So let's shift a bit to talk not about direct discrimination by sort of private actors, but to the portion of the Fair Housing Act that requires jurisdictions that receive federal urban and federal housing and urban development funding to take affirmative steps to address racial segregation and racial disparities in access to opportunities. And Myron, let me start with you and just ask you sort of, you've obviously written a lot about this, but what concrete steps should state and local governments take to live up to their obligations to affirmatively furthering fair housing?
Well, I think we have a very interesting history in Minnesota. In the 1970s, in conjunction with Walter Mondale's effort, the state took very far-reaching efforts. It implemented a visionary policy that was building about 70% of the subsidized housing in the whitest part of suburbia for 15 years. Metropolitan Council Policy 1339 kept our schools integrated for decades. It was abandoned in the 90s, in part because the cities wanted the money back to build housing in the central cities, and developers wanted the money back to build it in the cities. But it was a good policy, and returning to that would be a good thing. Another thing is we should look at the costs. You know, we have some strong providers in the suburbs like Dakota County that are building two-bedroom units for $220,000 that have $830 rents. This is fabulous. In the central cities, we're spending $500,000 to build the units, and we're having rents that are $1,200. And thinking about that cost differential, thinking about rewarding those providers like Dakota County and people that are providing low-income rents and allowing people choice. The Fair Housing Movement doesn't say everybody has to move. It just says everybody should have the chance to live wherever they'd like. The Fair Housing Act has never forced anybody to move anywhere. The Fair Housing Act just wants to provide choices. There's never been an example. We've limited choice, but expanding choice to all the communities is a goal. And it was something we did very well, and we've abandoned to build very expensive housing in very poor, segregated neighborhoods.
So thank you. I may circle back if we have time, circle back on sort of what we might need to do beyond that. But let me just turn directly to sort of Maureen about this question of sort of cost. I mean, I think that, and Myron, you and I have talked about this before. I know sort of certainly in New York City, the costs are much higher to build in higher income areas. But certainly developers often say that it's very difficult to build in whiter, more affluent sort of single family home neighborhoods. And so I wonder if sort of from your experience, Maureen, sort of what makes it so difficult to build in higher income areas? Why isn't there more building of not only of affordable housing, but of multifamily housing, even market rate multifamily housing? And what more, what do you think would be most helpful from the developer perspective? Like, what laws, incentives, what regulatory changes would be most helpful to you in as a developer and building in more affluent areas?
Sure. I'd say there's two main buckets to think about this issue in. One is land use policies and the other is financial tools. So from a land use policies perspective, it's about having more appropriate density along transit corridors in areas where it makes sense in communities. And that's been a challenge, particularly for our suburban communities. I mean, as a developer of multifamily housing, I mean, we have a need for 18,000 new units a year, according to the Federal Reserve and the Itasca project, until 2030 to meet our housing demands. And you do that most efficiently through larger multifamily apartment buildings than you can through single family homes or some such thing like that. So having that more density, particularly in suburban communities, the city of Minneapolis obviously is with the 2040 plan, which is now being contested, is really set up as a leader nationally to allow for more density. So it's not so much maybe in the core city in our region as it is more in the suburban communities where the land use policies are less progressive. And I would say that too, these policies need to be in place and in writing, because otherwise it creates opportunity for people to deny deny plans when a neighbor.
So do you mean that it has to be sort of as of right that.
Correct. Or, yeah. You know, within their land use policy, as opposed to, you know, seeking variances or other things, because it's just another way that the neighbors can say, well, we don't like the traffic.
That's right. You can technically allow it, but if you have to go through 17 different approvals, actively disallowing it.
Right. So I think that's part of it. And, you know, what we hear a lot of the NIMBY pushback on now is more around school issues, you know, overcrowding of schools and things like that. And, you know, having more families in the community. So it's kind of an interesting conversation of how the NIMBYism has shifted a little bit over time. In terms of financial tools, maybe mentioning a couple different things, you know, we've been talking about new market rate housing, and I want to talk about that first, but I also want to talk about NOAA preservation because that's equally important.
Which is naturally occurring affordable housing.
So in terms of the, you know, new market rate housing, you know, for every $10 in project costs, $6 is a mortgage, $3 is equity, and $1 is development funds. That's how we, on a market rate transaction, that's how it's funded. And so, In the higher income suburbs, we've seen some suburban development in the Twin Cities, and we've seen missing in the sort of middle market areas of the suburban communities, because typically those rents are lower. And so either developers can build affordable housing that's income restricted with subsidies because they can make the math work that way, or they can't build at all because the rents aren't high enough to make the math work. So the question is there opportunities with tax increment financing reform for maybe more of that attainable housing in the 80 to 100% of the area median income category? Right now, tax increment in the state of Minnesota is more focused on 60% of area median income or less, so that there's more of that continuum of housing. That might be an opportunity. Site prep by a government entity, so anything that drives down the cost of the land, the infrastructure, et cetera. And other supplemental sources, such as affordable housing trust funds in a city like Edina, they have a program for that as well. And you know, what drives the housing is how the capital is structured. And so you see that affordable housing developers, in particular nonprofits, are incentivized by the State Housing Finance Agency and others to go to specific areas because that is what gives them the most points in scoring and what gives them a tax credit boost at the federal level to fill the gaps in their funding. So the funding mechanisms really drive where the housing gets built. So I think that's important to note. And then just briefly note on NOAA preservation, you know, 90% of our housing market is considered market rate. And of the what's considered affordable housing in the region, 75% falls under that non-subsidized category. So that naturally occurring affordable housing that's not subsidized is really important. And maintaining that affordability is really important for the overall housing ecosystem. Because while the new market rate housing, Class A housing of today is the future naturally occurring affordable housing, we also need to preserve those NOAA new units. So providing gap funding for naturally occurring affordable housing purchases of buildings is good. Incentives such as the 4D tax credit program at the state level to drive property taxes down for those operators and housing providers that own that NOAA is really important as well. And then grants or opportunities for people to utilize to maintain those properties in good condition is also something else to be considered for funding mechanisms as well.
That's great. That's a fantastic list. I'm glad I hope this is being recorded so I can go back and take notes on that. I mean, one of the things, so it sounds like just also that the qualified allocation plan that guides the allocation of tax credits does give extra sort of bonus, right? Extra subsidies. That's what you were saying to developments in lower income neighborhoods.
Correct.
And that you're saying developers are sort of, therefore it's more profitable for them to.
But it's not that it's profitable. It's just more about filling the funding gap,
right?
Because it's 50% of the project, you know, sources is debt. And then the rest you have to fill with tax credits or grant funding or loans at the local level. And so if you get a tax credit basis boost by putting your development in a qualified census tract, then that helps fill that gap that you need to make.
I'm not as familiar. I mean, I off the top of my head, not that familiar with the Minnesota qualified allocation plan, but I know there's sort of a lot of other states have adopted counteracting preferences for sort of giving extra bonus points or priority points to developments that are located in you know, areas with higher performing schools and stuff. And that's something that actually does seem to actually sort of balance out the scales a little bit more, just sort of thinking concretely. So, all right. I'm going to turn to think I sort of cut off a little bit of disagreement between Myron and Shannon before, and I'm going right back to it, but Shannon, right, you spent a good part of your career at Hope Communities, building affordable housing in lower income neighborhoods and communities of color. How do you think, based on that experience, based on your own lived experience, how do you think that we can best balance the need for affordable housing in a variety of communities and further the goals of the Fair Housing Act through doing so?
Yeah, I appreciate Maureen's comments because there's so much around the way the funding mechanism works. Yes. That I think is really foundational to why it isn't working the way it should.
Yeah.
If we think about holding costs and how long it takes, how many funding mechanisms you have to have, mm-hmm. it actually costs more to build affordable housing than it does market rate housing. So that in and of itself, and the math doesn't work all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And even the formula that's probably being used, I would say, is a formula that no longer works. It hasn't considered community safety. It hasn't considered what happened post COVID, George Floyd, all of these things that our community, the equation has changed. And so I think starting there is really a basis. But I really think about housing as the continuum of where people are in their lives and that they should have a choice to live where they want at the price point that they are at. And I do believe that there are many false housing choices that are made based on the availability of where housing is. It may look like a choice, like I'm choosing to move here, but I'm moving there because that's the only place where I actually can afford rent, right? And that sometimes is not a full story of that. The other piece is, what does the housing continuum look like? So I look at Hope as a great example of, you can get 30% area median income all the way up to market rate, right? You can live. People are choosing to live on that corner, on that intersection. And they move oftentimes from the subsidized units into market rate units as their lives evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to make that choice. What I get, my question is when we develop in other areas that are higher income communities, if I decide to move with my kids when they're three, right, and stay there, and then I no longer qualify for the affordable housing and I'm ready to buy a home, is there going to be a home available in that community for me to purchase?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I now have to uproot my family and move to an area that has a home ownership price point that I can fit? So I think about, like, what are the things that we're doing around neighborhoods and communities that we can offer something along the continuum? And right now, the way things are set up, and I think there's a lot of really good, like, the intent was good, right? Like, the intent is good. And then you have these unintended consequences of, I have a family that I know that had to move out to Chaska and talks about the discrimination and everything that they were having to experience out there, adapted. And then when she went to purchase a home, had to move back into North Minneapolis, reestablished and did well. But all of that disruption, that the burden tends to be on the communities of color to move all the time. Right. And so what are the things that we can put in place? And I think that's what I've learned, is how do we create an environment that along that continuum that people, as they move and evolve in life and life happens, that they have a choice of where they can live. In the community of choice.
Yeah. So you said a lot there, right? That I just want to pull up just sort of a few things a lot of important things. I mean, one is that we really do need to pay attention to sort of the housing ladder and to sort of ways that it's not just about, I tend to focus a lot on rental housing, right? But it's not just about rental housing. We also have to think about where the affordable home ownership opportunities are as well. And particularly maybe given, you know, the history of wealth stripping in this country and from Black families in particular. So, but it also sounds like you're really underscoring to you, the Fair Housing Act is sort of, it's mostly, at its heart, it's about choice.
At its heart, it's about choice.
It's about choice. Yeah. So, Myron, let me turn to you and just say that you've obviously written a lot and thought a lot, as much as anybody, about the Fair Housing Act's mandate to affirmatively further fair housing. And so I wonder whether, you could talk, briefly just about, I feel like a little bit of the elephant in the room, and Greg mentioned this a little bit about the Supreme Court and whether, the current Supreme Court has not been friendly to racial preferences. And what does this mean for fair housing? And what particular aspects of the Fair Housing Act do you think are most at risk?
I think the Supreme Court is very hostile, and the Supreme Court, conservative justices are linking affirmative action. They're saying it's the same thing as racial integration in schools. It's the same thing as racial integration in housing. They're saying anything creates diversity as a racial classification. So it's very dangerous what's happening at the Supreme Court. And I think one of the reasons the stair step complaint was brought by the 100 Black churches against the State Housing Finance Agency and the Met Council is they'd like to establish state rights if the federal rights go away. Mm-hmm. They like to establish a safe harbor in Minnesota under the Supreme Court. New Jersey's doing this too. Yeah. We have a devastating situation here, and we're getting an alignment between the conservative court and also the affordable housing development community about what the Fair Housing Act means. That's dangerous in the Supreme Court and dangerous locally. And I think the clarity of the stair step case and the MICA case, which is a federal complaint, emphasizing the historic nature of these rights is really critical. They're disappearing at the federal level. We're not talking about the benefits of integration and the choices. One of the ironic things that's happening here is the suburbs are asking to build units, and we're turning them down. We're turning down Edina and Minnetonka.
Who is we?
The State Housing Finance Agency and the Met Council is turning down projects in very white affluent suburbs where they're putting money on the table and producing units at a lower cost, which is a strange situation, that this happening, that we're turning down these places. You're talking about the difficulties. We have all sorts of mechanisms there. The Dakota County HRA, as I was saying, could expand their capacity. Other suburban HRAs, they're building the units for a third less, a lot of times half of what they cost in the central cities with lower rents. Mm-hmm. And we're saying no to them, which is crazy, really, in lots of ways.
I actually realize I think I have like 7 minutes left. Yeah. So I want to jump into some of the questions from the audience, but there's one that follows up exactly on this, Myron, which is the sort of, and really to all of you, but maybe Myron, you in particular, just about, simply allowing, simply allowing multifamily housing in previously exclusively single family zones does not guarantee that the multifamily housing will be racially integrated. Do you all understand that it's critical that the housing choices of Black households need to be expanded to include those neighborhoods and that entities like the Oak Park Regional Housing Center are critical to expanding these choices? So I wonder if you can talk about that. And certainly, I've done some work showing that siting may not be enough, right? That even if we sort of get to where, what you would like is sort of a more balanced pattern of siting affordable housing in different communities, that we find that the affordable housing developments in whiter areas tend to be populated by whiter, higher income residents. And so do we need more in terms of providing more information, sort of affirmative marketing plans to make sure that the residents of developments, are that all low income, families in Minnesota know about, right, these new developments that are opening up. And again, they may not choose to live there, but at least they should know about them.
Yeah, I think density doesn't mean integration. I think it's good the city increased density. I supported the idea of this, but it without more affirmative measures, without race conscious measures, without counseling,
counseling doesn't have to be race conscious, right?
To some degree, it has to have a race conscious outcome. I mean, you can use race neutral criteria, but if you're not thinking about race, if you're not thinking about providing choices to Black and Latino households who really get discriminated against pervasively in all parts of the housing market, pervasive discrimination here in almost every piece of the house market, in mortgage lending discrimination and real estate treatment. We have some of the most sharpest disparities between Black and whites anywhere in the country in terms of the way our institutions are treating Black people. So you need some kind of a race conscious goal to make sure. I mean, I used to represent some of the densest neighborhoods of the city that were some of the whitest. Density doesn't mean integration. Mm-hmm. You have to think about it, and you have to provide counseling and choices. And we're really not doing
it. But even affordable housing doesn't necessarily mean integration.
If it's got fair housing rules, I mean, a lot of the developments that we're building in the city, the mm-hmm. artist housing, the expensive white artist housing, is not doing affirmative marketing plans. The agencies mm-hmm. aren't even beginning to make them comply with their mm-hmm. basic requirements under the Fair Housing Act. And that's really bad. You know, to build a $167 million project for artists that's mm-hmm. entirely occupied by white households that has, where the developer mm-hmm. had $500,000 of their own money into this. Yeah. This is a very lax city. The city of Minneapolis is very segregated in its housing patterns, and its housing policies in the last decade or two become extremely discriminatory.
So someone asked about high-rise public housing. And I wondered if you all could speak about sort of public housing program has traditionally been criticized as concentrating families with low incomes and concentrating communities of color, perpetuating segregation. But is there a way in the current world where we have a lot of gentrification? Do you think that there is there a role for public housing in kind of locking in diversity, do you think, she's just got a smile on her face. I don't even have to finish my sentence. And let me just say, locking in diversity in gentrifying neighborhoods.
So I think it's interesting that we're only worried about concentration of racialness when it's people of color.
Yeah.
So I think that's one, right? Like, no, I don't hear a whole lot of conversations that saying we need to break up
concentration of affluence,
right? Like there's no conversations around breaking up race unless we're talking about like people of color. So I think that's one. I always worry about solving for that.
Yeah.
Right. I also worry about solving for the breaking up of poverty, right? Are we solving for the jobs, or are we solving of just making sure that we don't have a bunch of impoverished people in the same building so that they're messing with the tax base? Right. So one, it doesn't feel like a people-centered approach. And so I worry about that. I do think that there is, if we have the right things in place around supporting people during their lives and where they're at, mm-hmm. there often tends to be, most folks are not like, oh, I want to be here forever. Right. Like when they have access to resources, when they have access to housing, when they have access to basic needs, access to educational opportunities, most folks will continue to evolve and grow. When I think about high rises with public housing, what I think about is, one, the federal government is not continuing to support the maintenance of those, right? No. So now we have a dignified experience, right? Of that, because they're poor, it doesn't look as good, or I have like a less of a dignified experience because I have to live in a place that doesn't look as good as if it was a for-profit thing. There's so much stuff layered in that, yeah. right? That yeah. if we flipped and focused on the families and not, you know, the land usage, all of these other things, and we start really focusing on people, I think we would start flipping where we're getting in the outcomes, mm-hmm. right? We need housing. And if it's all going to be in one unit, I do agree that there should be mixed income, mm-hmm. right? I do think mm-hmm. there's something around being next to a teacher and, you know, and, mm-hmm. and different folks in different occupations and being exposed to it. But we still need support, because right now it's not affordable for most individuals to purchase homes or live at market rate. You have to be making at least $110,000.
Yeah.
In Minneapolis to afford a market rate unit for a family of four.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know a whole bunch of people that are making that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I've gotten a signal now to wrap up, but I will just sort of say just one more thing. I think that is a really, really important note to end on, which is, just focusing on the people and not forgetting. I feel like as housing policy people, sometimes we focus on buildings, and we really need to focus on people. We need to focus on children. We need to focus on older adults. We need to, and I think thinking about also, you know, the mixed income communities, it may not be just about rubbing elbows. It may also just be about the kinds of resources and public services that higher income residents tend to be able to attract. So so please join me with that. I'm going to end. We could talk all day, but please join me in, thanking these terrific panelists.
Just going to quickly wrap up. You all can stay right there. Just take a second. I want to echo Ingrid's thank you to this great panel. Shannon, thank you very much. Myron Orfield and Maureen, thank you. Three quite distinct perspectives. It's a sign of the continuing debate over fair housing and where we are tonight. Ingrid, thank you so much. You're a terrific moderator. Any chance you want to move to Minnesota? Okay. Also, I want to thank our first panel, my colleague Ed Goetz and Greg Squires. That was really very helpful history where we want, where we've been and where we're going. Want to also acknowledge Penny and George, Penny and Bill George and the George Foundation for funding today's program and for our series on the Mondale legacy. I want to just give a quick shout out to programs we've got coming up. They're pretty crazy good. First off, we're going to have a program about should Donald Trump be on the presidential ballot in Minnesota. Those of you who've been following Article 14, Section 3, we're going to have an incredible program. On November 2nd, the Minnesota Supreme Court will be one of the first serious cases to have a hearing on this very issue. We've got some of the best people in the country coming here, and we're delighted to be pulling this together with the law school here at the University of Minnesota, the American Constitution Society, and the Federalist Society. So put that in your calendars. It's Monday, this Monday, October 30th, at 8:30 to 3. And all this will be streamed online as well as available for those who want to come here. On November 8th, from noon to 1, we're going to have a first look at the 2024 elections. I know, it's that close. And we've got two terrific people. They've both been high-level political consultants, Democratic and Republican sides. We've had them before, Kirsten Kukowski and Rebecca Piercy, who was Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign advisor, one of the first Black campaign directors. She's terrific. Both of them are terrific. Then we've got a program on November 14th at 12 Central Time. What's next for American democracy? If you're concerned at all about January 6th, this is a program with just an outstanding group of scholars and experts on the state of American democracy. Very excited for that as well. Okay, today's program, it will be available. For those who want to get it, it'll be a podcast and it will be on YouTube. If you've registered for the program, you will get an announcement about that. Give us 1 or 2 days, or you can search for it under Dialogue Across Difference. If you enjoyed this event, please consider making a donation. All of our events are free, but they do rely on financial support, and we do welcome that. Finally, thank you all for coming. This has been just a terrific set of conversations. Thank you once again to our panelists, our moderators. I also want to thank the people who actually pulled this off today, Sarah Benzkofer, Lee Chittenden, Cody, and our IT person who brings this to the world. So thank you all very much for that. And finally, reception. You've made it this long. We've got something for you to hang around and visit for a little bit. So once again, thank you very much.